week three. Well, we're really going to get stuck into it now, in a sense. I wanted to say, just because it's a bit glib, if the Heart Sutra is about anything, then it's about nothing. But it's not strictly true. But it is about emptiness. And if it's about anything, then it's about emptiness. And that's really what we're going to get into this week, which is really, in some ways, you could say, it's the heart of the Heart Sutra, or the essence of the essence of the Prajnaparamita. So that's what we're going to try and tackle in two parts. So the first of all, we're going to have a look at the five skandhas. Five skandhas are traditional means of breaking down the universe into bite-sized chunks. It actually means heaps. The word skanda means heap. And the Heart Sutra talks about the five skandhas a fair bit. So we were just going through them just now. So, for example, lines 5 to... Well, certainly 5 to 12, where it talks about form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form, form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. And then feeling, thought and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. So what on earth is Avalokiteshvara talking about? Well, he's talking about the five skandhas, basically. So let's just sort of go through those with an example. So let's say we're wandering along minding our own business, and we come across a sign, let's say a wooden sign on a stick in the ground, something like that. So the first thing we've got is form, or in traditional Sanskrit, rupa, just as a Buddha figure is sometimes called a rupa. So in English form, in Sanskrit, rupa. So this basically is everything outside of ourselves. Everything that objectively exists. So this, you, me, all the atoms and everything that goes to make up the universe, as well as the properties as well. So temperature, roughness, smoothness, colour, that sort of thing. So you might think, well, that's everything, isn't it? But no, that's only the first one of the skandhas. So that's form. So when we're wandering along and we see this sign, the sign is rupa. It does objectively exist as far as we can figure out. So then secondly, we can talk about vedana. Or in English, feeling. Or sensation. So we see the sign. How do we see the sign? Because the light bounces off the sign into our eyes, and our eyes register the photons of light coming in. So that's the feeling or sensation. It's simply the kind of mechanical registering of our sense organs. And so, of course, it's not just eyes, it's our nose, our taste, our sense of touch, and so on. So vedana is simply the relatively mechanical act of sensing. I'm going to change colours now, just because the blue's running a bit low. Next then, in the list, we've got samnya, which is discriminative thought. Exclusive thought or perception. So this is where we do a bit of figuring out in our minds. So whereas this is just the pure sensing, using our sense organs, this is where our mind actually gets involved and tries to work out what it is that we are seeing or smelling or sensing or whatever it might be. So in this case, we've seen the sign objectively exists, the light, the photons of light bounce off the sign into our eyes so we can see it. And then we try and make sense. What's on this sign? Something's written on this sign, isn't it? I can see the writing. So this stage here could be reading. So then that takes us to the fourth skandha, which is in many ways the key one. samskara, choice or volition. So we objectively understand what's happening. We've read it, we've decoded it, whatever it might be. You know, it's the way we try and make faces out of clouds, or, you know, all that cloud looks like Ireland, as the Kate Bush song goes. You know, the way we try to make sense of things, you know, trying to decode things. And then this is what we choose to do at that point. So let's say there's a sign here, can see the sign, we read it, it turns out that it says, you are an idiot. So then you've got a choice now, with the samskaras. What do you do? You could get angry. What do people do about saying I'm an idiot? They don't even know who I am. What are they doing? That's a bit rude, isn't it? Or you could just smile and think, oh, that's quite funny, isn't it? You know, go around with a sign that says, that's your choice. This is the bit where you can choose to go one way or the other, to get angry, to laugh, or whatever it might be. And then finally, there's consciousness, vijnana, which is the awareness in which all of this takes place. And being, you know, self-aware beings, we can be aware of this process taking place in ourselves. We can see the arising, or be aware of the arising of our anger, or our humour, or our frivolousness, or whatever it might be. You know, we can have some sort of consciousness of that. Whereas it's interesting reflecting on what, for example, an animal, a cat or a dog might, what their world is like. So, you know, they have a form. So for a dog, form might take much more the world of smell, for example. Feeling a sensation, you know, they could take in things through their sense organs like we do, although obviously they have different priorities to their sense organs. They make some sense of that. They figure out what's going on. Hello, you know, I recognise this, or whatever it might be. Obviously they don't use those words necessarily, but... And then a choice of volition. You know, if it's a guard dog, it might recognise its owner and be very happy in its tail wagging back. If it's a burglar, or somebody it sees as a threat, obviously doesn't know he's a burglar, but it, you know, somebody it sees as a threat, the dog may get angry and vicious. So this is where the dog has some sort of choice. But the difference, I suppose, or one of the differences anyway, is that the dog isn't self-aware about what's going on, presumably, as far as we can tell. You know, the dog doesn't think, oh, I'm getting a bit angry here. You know, it just kind of responds in that way. Whereas we do have much more control over our volition, though it doesn't always feel like it. So those are the five skandhas. And according to, you know, traditional Buddhist theory, then the whole universe, our whole universe, that is to say, which is probably more important to us personally in many ways, our whole universe could be divided into these five heaps. Rather than saying, you know, all the atoms in the universe, or all the material in the universe, which is all basically effectively covered by this first one. But really, our universe, you know, to a large extent, takes place in our minds. And so we've got all these other things going on. So these are the things that get mentioned in the Heart Sutra. He talks about form, feeling, thought, choice, and consciousness. Okay, I think it's very worthwhile thinking about these things. And it's also, the boundaries between these are not necessarily that clear. I suppose that the boundary there is pretty clear, but often where things are between here and here, you know, it can quite get a little bit vague, and it's worth sort of puzzling over and reflecting on what's going on for you as an individual. So, having said that, one of the first things then that Avalokiteshvara talks about in this sutra is that these things are empty. Or to use the term in Sanskrit, shunyata, which in many ways is a better term to use because emptiness tends to imply something. You know, we understand something from the word emptiness, which may not be quite what shunyata is saying. Nevertheless, it's probably the best word we've got in English. So he says that these things are empty. That's to say, they don't have any intrinsic nature of themselves, of their own. When you start to examine these, when you, for example, sit down and meditate on these various things, there's very little, if anything, that you can actually put your finger on when you start to reflect upon them and become aware of them. Avalokiteshvara makes the point that, in fact, everything is shunyata. Everything is empty. Emptiness. Nothing has any substantial existence of its own. So you could talk about this in the, as being affliction, for example, as I did earlier when I said I was going to get it. But But if I was to take the paper off and put it over there, then we'd be left with not a flip chart, but we'd have a piece, you know, a flip chart pad over there and a flip chart stand over here. So where is the flip chart then? It doesn't, you know, kind of exist. It's not until these come together that then the flip chart exists. So if it doesn't exist, where has it gone? Well, of course, it hasn't actually gone anywhere. It's kind of never existed in a sense in the first place. Another example, say, is let's say you've got a car. Let's say my car outside now. If I just left it there and walked home, and eventually, over a period of time, it would slowly decay, wouldn't it? Over a period of years, over decades, it would fall apart, and eventually it'd just be a big wreck there. Well, you could ask yourself, well, at what point does it stop being a car, and at what point does it start being a wreck? Well, there is no fixed point. You can't say at a certain point it's a car, and at a certain point it's a wreck. So when was it? So is it a car at all? The point of this is trying to argue, I suppose, is although we conveniently use labels for things, in practice, things don't have a substantial nature of their own, and labels really are for our own convenience and shouldn't be thought of as anything more than that. No thing, for example, is strictly speaking a thing because it's not isolated from anything else. Everything is in relationship with everything else. In the same way that the sign I talked about earlier has photons bouncing out of it, is slowly decaying over a period of time, it's continually interacting with its environment. So it's not a discrete entity, and neither is anything else. There are no fixed, unchanging things. Whether it's the car, that if you leave it will just slowly decompose, or an orange that will slowly break down if you leave it for a few days, or a building, which, you know, may take hundreds of years, but sooner or later it will crumble. These walls, for example, they might seem quite fixed, but we think of them as being things, when really everything is a process, like your orange, which starts off as a flower, well, starts off before then, but, you know, let's say it starts with a flower and a bud. Is it bud and a flower? Bud and a flower, isn't it? Bud, then flower, then a little orange, you know, that's all green, presumably, and then it becomes, ripe. Orange, and then it becomes overripe and as you say, decays to dust, and then, you know, that gets blown away and then there's nothing. So there's a whole process there. And whilst at some point you could say, well, yes, it's a bud now, it's a flower now, it's an orange now, in fact, there's no clear boundaries between those things. It's just a process that we conveniently label in certain ways, or we label in certain ways for our convenience. But to think of that thing as a fixed entity is erroneous, because it's not. It's a process. There's a joke I used to like when I was young, and it was about, I don't know, it might have been the two runners or something like that. It sounds like their sort of joke. And they're saying, oh, I've still got the same broom that I've had for 20 years. I've changed the handle 5 times and I've changed the broom head 3 times, but it's still the same broom. And it's kind of a bit like that with this, actually. Yeah, I mean, again, an example of a car. You could have a car, and over a period of time you could change all the tyres, and it would still be your car, and then you could change the engine if it went wrong. Still be your car. You could change the doors. Eventually, you could change every single thing, bit by bit by bit, until there's nothing left originally, but you'd still say, well, yes, but that's my car, isn't it? I've had this car for 15 years. Even if you've not had any bit of that car for 15 years. So things are a process that change over time. In addition to this, everything is also dependent upon conditions. We can only actually live as we are now, operate in the way that we do now, in a very, very small environment, a very thin surface layer of a particular planet, which is an extremely small environment, actually. And if you were, you know, to think of the rest of space, even in the local region, you know, we couldn't survive in space, we couldn't survive in Jupiter, we couldn't survive near the Sun, or on any other planet for that matter, or the Moon, let alone deep space. It's only in a very small place that we can actually survive. So we are very, very dependent upon our conditions, just like everybody else. If we were in a vacuum, we'd look very, very different, or on the Sun, or on or some massive planet. Often we'd be squashed or exploded or something like that. This can be difficult to see, because all of our experience in space and time is coextensive with our own lives. So we tend to see things from our own point of view. We tend to imagine the universe from our own perspective, which is perfectly reasonable, because that's all we know. All we know is from the very first memories, when we started to gain our own self-consciousness and self-awareness, up to now. That's our entire perspective. So it's not unreasonable that we see things from that perspective of an individual who doesn't appear in many ways to change, to be quite fixed, and has these other fixed things around them. There's a particular practice that's done in our movement just before ordination, which is supposed to be related to spiritual death, the idea of spiritual death, and then during the ordination it's a spiritual rebirth. And this is a six element practice where you focus upon each of the six elements. You've seen the film The Six Elements, haven't you? Or is it the five elements? It's the sixth senses, isn't it? Five elements. Anyway, this is six elements, which is solid material, liquid material, gaseous material, heat or electrical energy, or you might see it as space itself, the space that one occupies, and consciousness. And you imagine all those one by one, you imagine each of those elements as they exist in your body, as they come to be in your body, and as they leave your body. So this process, this flow of material that comes into your body and goes out of your body and then returns to the wider world. You focus on each of those, including the space that you occupy, which eventually will be returned to the universe, and consciousness itself, your own consciousness. I'm going to say more about this later when I talk about shunyata, and I'm quite happy to. It is, I think, quite a perplexing and tricky subject, which in some ways makes it very interesting. It's certainly well worth reflecting upon, I think. I'm just going to finish this little bit, though, with some words from Richard Dawkins. You know Richard Dawkins at all? The big, very popular with the Christian Church. And, I think he does some very good stuff. I wouldn't agree with necessarily everything he says, but I think he writes I think he's a very sharp mind indeed, and he writes some very, very good stuff indeed. And I'd like to read just this quote from him, which I think is quite useful. Well, I find it useful anyway. So he says, "If solid things are mostly empty space, why don't we see them as empty space? Why does a diamond feel hard and solid instead of crumbly and full of holes? The answer lies in our evolution. Our sense organs, like all our bits, have been shaped by Darwinian natural selection over countless generations. You might think that our sense organs would be shaped to give us a true picture of the world as it really is, which is, after all, what we're trying to get at with Buddhism. It is safer to assume that they have been shaped to give us a useful picture of the world to help us survive. In a way, what sense organs do is assist our brains to construct a useful model of the world, and it is this model that we move around in. It is a kind of virtual reality simulation of the real world. Neutrinos can pass straight through a rock, but we can't. If we try to, we hurt ourselves. When constructing its simulation of rock, the brain therefore represents it as hard and solid. It's almost as though our sense organs are telling us, you can't get through objects of this kind. That's what solid means. That's why we perceive them as solid. In the same way, we find much of the universe, as science discovers it, difficult to understand. Einstein's relativity, quantum uncertainty, black holes, the Big Bang, the expanding universe, the vast slow movement of geological time. All these things are hard to grasp. No wonder science frightens some people. But science can even explain why these things are hard to understand and why the effort frightens us. We are jumped up apes, and our brains were only designed to understand the mundane details of how to survive in the Stone Age African savannah."